This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. President Trump saying he's made a deal with congressional Republicans who earlier today voted against advancing his priority crypto legislation. Several hardline holdouts had concerns that the measures could be a backdoor to a central bank digital currency. The president says the rule vote will happen tomorrow. In Minnesota, Vance Belter has been indicted in connection with the deaths of a state lawmaker and her husband. Acting U.S. District Attorney of Minnesota Joseph Thompson.
Count one of the indictment charges the defendant with the stalking of Melissa Hortman with the intent to murder Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark Hortman.
Belter also allegedly shooting State Senator John Huffman and his wife. An arrest in the Los Angeles murders of American Idol music supervisor Robin Kay and her husband, 22-year-old Raymond Buterin, is accused of breaking into their home while the couple was out. While they came home, there was allegedly a struggle and then he shot and killed them. This is ABC News.
We bring the excitement to you from wherever the Milwaukee Brewers are playing on WRCE FM 107.7 AM 1450 in Richland Center.
A new champion in the Home Run Derby. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball slugger Cal Raleigh of the Seattle Mariners won the Home Run Derby in Atlanta. Raleigh with a total of 54 home runs hit. The All-Star game going on tonight. Freddy Peralta, rookie Jacob Mizorowski, and closer Trevor McGill all there to represent the Brewers. McGill asked, where did reaching the All-Star game rank on his list of goals this season?
This was number one for me this year. You guys asked me earlier this season, and I kept it to myself that this is what, you know, I was striving for. And a lot of hard work and a lot of pitchers in front of me, a lot of my bullpen guys in front of me, you know, putting it down and giving me the opportunity to go out there and get saves this year. So, without the guys around me, this probably wouldn't be possible.
Basketball, it's the Bucks and the Chicago Bulls tomorrow in Las Vegas in summer league action. How hard is it to build a roster these days? GM John Horst.
I think the NBA is as compelling and competitive today as it's ever been.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Been really interesting watching the Red Hats, my MAGA friends, losing their mind over the Epstein files. And the reality is I want to talk to my Red Crew. I want to talk directly to those working people who have stood by Donald Trump through thick and thin. You guys who shrugged off every scandal, every rude, crude, obscene tweet, every broken promise, all of it, because you believed he was your guy. He was in your corner. He was fighting for you. He was going to go after those elites. He was going to drain the swamp, going to do all that stuff. And look, I understand for years you've watched your media and the political class lose their mind. Every time Trump did something or there was a headline, none of the scandals moved you, didn't move you a bit. You didn't care. You stayed loyal. You said, well, you know, he's not perfect, but he's our guy. He's going to blow up that corrupt system. Never worked for us anyway. He's going to do it. And you made peace with the lies, the obfuscation, the business deals that screwed working people, the vulgarity. Because, you know, somewhere deep down, and it had to be really deep down, you believed he was going to deliver. He was going to come through for you. He was going to bring those jobs back, enrich those communities, revive the reward for work, going to bring back the American dream. You bought it. And look, I get it. Bernie Sanders ran on the same thing. Only I believed Bernie. But now we're in a weird moment because there's a little chink in the armor. There's something there, and this is a little different. These Epstein files have got, I don't know, it seems, I may be proven wrong, but it seems like this is kind of a line in the sand that the Red Hat world isn't willing to cross. I mean, look, I get it. You know, for years you had Trump and all of his mouthpieces, you know, promising that they were going to expose the truth of Epstein Island. And they were going to go after all those powerful men who preyed on children. The Q people were going to be finally proven correct. Oh, we were going to get those pervs. They've gotten away with it all these years, but time is up. And all because they had money and connections to get out of it. And you were told, we were all told, the files would be released, the swamp would be emptied, and justice would finally reach. They were going to reach the untouchables. You were promised Bill Clinton's head on a platter. And you believed it because, you know, you kind of know what it's like to watch the rich and the well-connected skate by while regular folks like us get crushed every time. But I'm looking at right now and I'm looking at this moment and going, why is this different? And I think it's because you realized what you got. We've got a Justice Department memo that's saying there's nothing to see. Move along. Nothing to see here. No client list, no evidence, just a bunch of redacted pages. And a shrug. And Trump, who himself once teased out that there would be explosive truth, is now telling you nothing to see here. Move along. It's a distraction now. It's all Hillary and Obama and Biden. They did it. The janitor, even. Anyone but Trump is responsible. And his administration says it can't release anymore because, you know, there's some kind of technicality that they get to hide behind. And then they tell you what politicians say. Remember, Trump told you he wasn't a politician and you bought it. But now we get to trust us. There's nothing here, nothing to see. And I find it somewhat encouraging that even the most loyal of the loyalists in his own MAGA media, his own FBI director, are trying to figure out, are kind of eating each other over what's being kept secret. And look, I know you've forgiven Trump for an awful lot. You've looked past the bankruptcies, the multiple bankruptcies. You look past the hush money to the porn star, the insults that went out, the broken factories, the tax cuts that never seemed to ever trickle down to you and me. All of that. And you just kind of like, you know, it's just Trump being Trump. It's our guy. But this seems different. This, maybe I'm wrong, but this seems like the one thing you're not going to allow to go by. This seems to matter. And it's weird to me that this is it. Not the fact that we've taken food out of the mouths of children, not the fact that, you know, they're kicking the poor, none of that. This seems different. This seems like the one thing that really matters. And I guess it's because you were promised that they were going to go after the rich and the powerful. They were going to go after and finally hold them accountable for anything, something. And now it looks like Trump's just another politician protecting not just the elite, not just keeping their secrets, but I think keeping his as well, maybe. And now he's hoping you're going to let this slide too. I don't know. And the things that are interesting to me is the scandals that hurt the most aren't the ones that your enemy makes. Like this really doesn't, I expect this for Trump. It's the one your own people. So this is where I think the Red Hats are losing their mind because they're feeling betrayed by their guy. And look, there are a lot of people tonight on that side of the equation who are asking themselves, you know, If Trump will give us the information on this, not going to tell us the truth about Epstein, what else isn't he telling? And why does this, of all things, finally break that cult? Is it because you knew he was flawed all along and you believed he was on your side? And now for the first time, the reality is he's not? He's one of them? Look, it's not just a political crisis for Trump. This seems like it could be the betrayal that cuts really deep for the people who put their faith in him. Tell the truth. Hold the powerful accountable. This is that kind of simple message that I think, I'm hoping, my Red Hat crew kind of looks at Trump for what he has always been. In my view, a con man. In my view, one of the more deplorable people I've ever encountered. But we've known that. And I've had my religious friends tell me the biblical story of being stuck in a flood and God sending the imperfect to come and get you and you send them away. He's not perfect. He's who God sent us. And he's played that card masterfully. The question is this the straw that breaks the camel's back? Is this the bridge too far? Of all of the other things, is this it? Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? So I want to hear from my Red Hat crew. I want to hear from my Trump supporter friends who, are you still on Team Trump? Are you going to give the pass? Is if these files aren't released, if Democrats don't get them pushed out, if we don't get to see the stuff, is this the bridge too far? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a lot of email around the big, beautiful bill the last several days. And interestingly enough, I guess it depends on who you voted for in the last election. Because my Red Hat friends say this is a game changer. This is going to rebuild the middle class. This is going to help prosperity return to working people. And then I've got folks on my side of the aisle going, I'm not seeing it. What I'm seeing is more for the very wealthy, a lot more, and well, for the folks at the bottom, a real screw job. And here to share some thoughts on, is this a victory for working people? And if so, what is it? That's why I've asked Joe Hughes to come talk with us. Joe is senior analyst at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP.org, their website, if you want to check out the work they do. Joe, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm getting all this response that this is a game changer. This is going to make lives better. Working people are going to keep more of their money in their pocket. You know, the Fox News line. This is working class utopia.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it like you. So what we know about this bill is that it gives $1 trillion in tax cuts to the top 1%. And at the same time, it kicks millions of people off their health insurance. So it's almost difficult to imagine a bill that simultaneously blows up the deficit to the extent that this bill does, it also takes a carving knife to health and income support programs. But, you know, kudos to them. They managed to do the impossible, I guess.
Well, let's start with the positives. Is there anything in here you see that is positive for working people?
So the White House and their paid talking heads, they want to talk about no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. Those things were a pretty small portion of the overall cost of the tax cuts in the bill. Together, those things are less than 4% of the tax cuts. And so this bill is sort of like the administration saying, hey, we're going to take the very wealthy out to a 5-course meal at a Michelin star restaurant, and then telling the middle class, hey, yeah, we'll pick you up some McDonald's on the way home.
Yeah, I kind of see it the same way, even if that, maybe the McDonald's that came out of the trash can, because, you know, the sad reality is the no tax on tip things we talked about all during the campaign when it first came up. The majority of tipped workers don't earn enough to pay federal tax. So this doesn't really benefit them. And then it's a little complicated to get through that you're probably going to need someone to do your taxes to actually benefit from it. Or am I reading this wrong?
No, you're exactly right. Most of the taxes that tip workers pay are payroll taxes. They're Social Security taxes, Medicare taxes. Those things are not going to be exempt at all. What is exempt is the first $25,000 of tips that apply to your individual income taxes. So they're not really getting a very large tax cut from this. And in fact, if we go beyond just tipped workers, if you include the tariffs that this administration is implementing, most of the middle class really comes away no better at all. And for the bottom 40% of Americans, they're actually made worse off because they're paying increased prices on their consumption, and they're getting a very small tax change on the individual income tax, right? And so that doesn't even include the cuts to people's health insurance or their food security from SNAP or other things.
Because, you know, we talked about yesterday on the program that, you know, the bottom 20% are actually going to see a pretty substantial decrease in their income because of the loss of some subsidy programs like SNAP, like Medicaid, some of those things that actually, you know, work is not going to pay and not be rewarded, and kind of the opposite of what we really should be pushing for.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But you know, what the on the other side of this, what the top 1% are getting is trillions of dollars over the next 10 years, right?
So, you know, but that's a given. Look, every time a tax bill goes through, I know that Republicans are going to push for more for the very wealthy. And look, that's fine, well, and good. We've lost that battle. The Republicans are all in for giving them as much as they want, as much as they can give. I kind of get that to a degree because that's where their bread and butter is. But shouldn't you leave some crumbs for everybody else? I mean, in the old days, at least, you know, spread it around a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that's what the middle class and the working class gets here is crumbs. And in some cases, as you said, spoiled crumbs out of the trash can, right? They're actually being made worse off. But, you know, it's no surprise, like you said, this is the same thing that happened in 2017, which a large part of this bill is just simply extending the 2017 tax law. But back then, as is the case now, the fundamentals of the bill were an enormous tax cut for the top 1% for business owners. And then we'll kind of string the middle class along. We'll offer them some morsels.
Yeah. And look, even the things that I view in this that could be marginally good, the increase in the child tax credit from $2,000 to $2,200, except if you're at the bottom, you're only going to get $1,400 because, hey, we've put that into place. And also the baby bond or whatever it is they've thrown in there. Again, if it's one of those things that, you know, if you're at the bottom, not going to benefit fully from. There are a couple of things you go, well, these were crumbs, but I don't even know that they were, you know, worthy to call crumbs.
Yeah. If you look at the child tax cut, the child tax credit specifically, I'm glad you just mentioned that. This increase from $2,000 to $2,200 is really nothing. If you look at the inflation adjusted amount, from when they first expanded the tax credit in 2017, even going up to $2,200, it's less now than it would have been in 2018 when the bill first passed. And it does nothing whatsoever for the millions and millions of children who are not receiving the credit because of the income restrictions. Right. And they are income restrictions. Republicans like to talk about work requirements. There are no work requirements on the child tax credit. If you have a lot of investments and you're making money off of your investments, but you're not working, you can receive the child tax credit. At the same time, you can be working 40 hours a week, but you're not making enough for your family to receive the full child tax credit. So they're not work requirements, they're income restrictions.
That's beautiful. I mean, because look, you can't get Medicaid if your children are sick, if you're not working, or if you're sick, we can get CHIP for kids. But if you're sick, sorry, you're out of luck. Because I'm looking at these Medicaid cuts and talking to healthcare professionals who are really worried about what it's going to do to the healthcare industry in this country. And look, I've got some of my red hat friends who are like, let it all collapse and, you know, we'll start all over again, which is all fine, well, and good if you're one of the people who are going to die because of it. I'm okay with that on a certain level. But for the rest of us, I'm not there yet, Joe.
Yeah, and I'm not the Medicaid expert, so I don't want to go into, you know, what the vice president called the minutiae of Medicaid policy. But I'll just reiterate what I said earlier. It's almost hard to even fathom a bill that makes enormous cuts to Medicaid and also explodes the deficit. That's almost hard to even do,
yeah.
But they managed to do it.
No, and this is one of the weird things, because if I remember right, you know, didn't Trump run on, he was going to solve our debt problems day one. We were going to do away with deficits. We're going to pay off the debt. We were going to be rolling in dough, because he's a businessman. He's a smart businessman. Thoughts?
Well, he certainly ran on that, and some people believed him, but I never did myself, and I think this bill pretty well demonstrates that he never intended to deliver on that promise, as previous Republican administrations have done. They've talked a lot about the debt and the deficit when they're running for office, and then when they get into office, suddenly it's no longer such a priority.
Now, you know, the response that I've had to a lot of my red hat friends is, yeah, he's going to run the country just like he ran his businesses into bankruptcy, because this bill adds a lot to the debt, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. It's by some measures, it's the most expensive bill in history, right? The in terms of how much it increases the debt, that depends on your how much growth you expect out of this, how you think that the labor market is going to respond. But by pretty much any measure, including ones from conservative organizations, it's going to be, if not the most costly bill in history, then at least it's cracking the top five, right?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I've been looking at is the reality that this is, during the Biden administration, I was talking about the potential of transformational change. That, you know, Biden was turning the ship and moving away from neoliberalism and you know, doing some things that I thought were positive. This bill completely undoes all of that and basically repeals most of the progress, I think, of the 20th century. And I hate saying that because it sounds hyperbolic, but when you're talking about cutting almost $1 trillion from us, our social safety net programs, I don't know how else you can look at it.
Yeah, and that's you're talking about the social safety net programs. It also cuts billions and billions of dollars of investments in what people have deemed industrial policy to build the energy future here in America, to build solar plants and battery factories here in America, and things that Republican legislators themselves were going and cutting the ribbons in their own districts, celebrating these things. Yeah, those things are being cut as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, again, the progress that was made is being completely undone right before our very eyes. You talk about energy, and I remember Trump running on, you know, we're gonna change energy policy. It's going to make gas cheap. We're gonna be able to buy eggs for a buck, and gas is gonna be 90 or eggs for 99 cents, gas for a buck. I don't even remember at this point, but life was supposed to get a lot cheaper. And does this do any of that, or is it actually what I've been reading? Energy prices are going to go up even higher because of what they've done.
Yeah, I could certainly see a world where energy prices go up, because the fact is that a lot of fossil fuels, especially if you're talking about coal, that's not being phased out because of, you know, some sort of nanny state government making people build solar plants. It's just become less cost efficient than it was in the past. And so now these newer forms of energy that are more cost efficient, wind and solar, they're getting tax increases as a result of this bill. So it's certainly possible that we're going to see energy prices go up. But I think even at the grocery store, if you take the net effects of not just this bill, but also of the administration's tariff policy, over time, consumers are going to pay the prices of tariffs.
I look at the tariff policy and look at it, and this is a tough spot for me because I'm not an anti-tariff person. I think in a toolbox full of economic tools, tariffs are a part of it. I said from the beginning, I thought he was going to use the tool in a way that is more than ill-advised, and that he would screw it up so badly that no one would ever touch the T word ever again. And a lot of the responses that I've been getting from people are, we should never, ever consider tariffs ever, 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 not even clinically. And I'm going, yeah, I don't know about that so much, because there are things that we do need it for. But you're right, you know, when you're talking about the overall trade and the way that he's wielded this tool, I think it's going to be harmful, and I think it's going to hurt especially low-wage working people in this country.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp as you. I don't think that tariffs are a dirty word necessarily that should never, ever be used. There are certain applications for critical industries, for steel, for certain pharmaceuticals that I think it definitely makes sense that it's in our national interest to produce these things in our country and ensure that we have the capacity to do so if there is another global emergency like there was in 2020. But there are other things like bananas that I don't think it's a national security issue that we're importing bananas from Brazil or wherever we import bananas from, right? And the fact of the matter is, set the tariff rate to 10,000%, we're never going to produce bananas at scale in the United States.
No, and you're right on that. And this is where having sane, rational people doing trade policy is kind of important, instead of what we've seen out of Trump, which is just kind of however he feels today. Because I maybe you see it differently, but I don't see a strategy here. I see the spaghetti theory at work here. But based on how he feels, or maybe how his toast was cooked in the morning, I don't know, but I don't see a strategy.
Yeah, I'm not myself even certain what the current tariff policy is or when they're supposed to go fully into effect. I think I knew about 5 minutes before we started this call, but it might have changed since then, so I'm not sure.
And that's how it generally works, and that's the sad reality. And if our trading partners, and because we're seeing a lot of reports that they're organizing, the one thing that you can say that Donald Trump is doing is he is uniting the world. Unfortunately for us, I think it's going to be against us. But that's, I guess, if that's a positive.
Yeah, I'm not sure that is a positive. I think we've seen that with recent reports that tourism from out of the country is plummeting right now.
Yeah,
I think Las Vegas is experiencing one of the biggest unemployment rates in the country right now, just from a loss of tourism.
Yeah, I think I read something before. It's like 40% Canadian tourists are down, like 40% this month over last month, which, wow, not good for us. Last question. I want to go back and I want to make sure I get this right, because, you know, again, we were told this was supposed to be about helping working families. This was supposed to be about making lives cheaper, groceries cheaper, energy prices cheaper, gas prices, you know, health insurance, all this stuff cheaper. Any world that you see that happening with this because of this bill?
I don't see that happening. In my opinion, what I see happening is that the middle class gets screwed by this bill. Despite the appearance of these middle class tax cuts, they could have provided those tax cuts to workers, to families, and they could have even provided substantial increases to things like the child tax credit that we mentioned earlier, or the earned income tax credit. And it would have, in fact, cost significantly less. And if they had pursued things like Biden's proposed billionaire income tax, higher taxes on stock buybacks, they maybe could have even paid for those things entirely.
Yep.
But instead, they chose to blow up the deficit, further blow up the deficit, and kick people off their health care.
Yeah, but you know, they got their gold star. They got what they wanted, which is kicking the poor and the disabled and the folks at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. They did a good job of kicking them in the teeth in looking at this bill. But Joe, I appreciate the time. As always, great talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Joe Hughes, senior analyst at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you think this is going to be the answer? Do you think this bill is going to be everything that I'm told it's cracked up to be? The savior of the reward to work? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around.
This is News from the Center, WRCE.
We bring the excitement to you from wherever the Milwaukee Brewers are playing on WRCE FM 107.7 AM 1450 in Richland Center.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight with a slight storm chance, warm and muggy, lows upper 60s to 70. Mostly cloudy for tomorrow with scattered showers and thunderstorms. Warm and muggy, a high in the mid 80s. Clearing out and cooler Thursday, currently 81 degrees.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Stephanie Bloomingdale, president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. The big brutal bill is basically an all-out assault on working Americans.
No tax on tips. It's not as good as it sounds because a lot of tipped workers are not paying that higher level of taxes right in the first place.
As the wealthiest among us dine at the feast of all feasts, don't be fooled by the table scraps.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So interestingly enough, after yesterday's show, got a bunch of red hat emails accusing me of just being anti-Trump, which, because of just how bad he is, but blaming me for saying that Donald Trump didn't cause the flood. And no, I never said Donald Trump caused the flood. I never said Republicans caused the flood. They're not God. There's no flood laser, even though I know there are people who think that we can do that. What I said, very clear, is this is Republican governance. Ill-prepared, defunded, and, well, anti-government, which is weird. Why you would ever vote for someone who tells you to your face, I don't believe in your government. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what's going on with NOAA, what's going on with the flood information, what's going on with our energy policy, and all of that, I've asked Margaret Cooney to come talk with us. Margaret is the Senior Campaign Manager for Energy and Environmental Policy there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, americanprogress.org. Margaret, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So what do you make? Help me through this, because, again, I've got all these red hats going, you know, you're blaming Donald Trump for the weather. No, not the weather, the response. Because had this been Joe Biden or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or anybody else, well, heads would be rolling.
Yeah, well, I think from the beginning, one of the issues was just basically the job cuts, the budget cuts, with the National Weather Service and NOAA. And then in the last few days, we're seeing it with the budget and staffing cuts at FEMA. I mean, the administration cut nearly 600 staff members from the National Weather Service. And this is at a time when 40% of the forecast offices are understaffed. And I want to acknowledge and applaud the incredible effort of the forecasting office and the National Weather Service personnel, who gave accurate forecasts in a timely manner. To the best of their ability with the staffing and resources that were available to them. Yeah. And so you saw that the forecasting was good. You saw it was accurate. It was timely. But then there was this gap in coordination between the forecasting office and the emergency managers on the ground. And when you look back at it, there is a key position that was empty in that forecasting office that specifically is there for coordination purposes. And so when you see cuts like that, personnel, budget, and then you're like, whoa, hold on, what happened? Why, where did it break down? And you're like,
it's a straight line. It's a straight line. There's no wiggle room. Straight line. Right back to Trump and Doge and this administration's policies.
Yeah. And we're seeing similar things in the last week with FEMA. I mean, they've been gutting since he came into office. Trump has openly said that he wants to get rid of FEMA, at least in its current iteration. They've gutted funding. They've hindered the response and staff capacity of FEMA. And it's just going to make Americans, as we've been seeing with the Texas floods, way more vulnerable in these situations. Like, who is going to be there to coordinate across agencies, federal, state, local municipalities, emergency management workers? I mean, you're looking at a response that comes not just from the National Weather Service or just from FEMA, but they're pulling from the Army Corps of Engineers, the Forest Service, anybody that they can get a hold of, and even other states, because when things like this happen, it's so important for us to come together and use every resource available to us to help people in this situation.
Yeah, and for me, you know, I look at this, and yesterday on the program, I took aim at Republican policy, and you're not in a partisan, and I'm not asking you to get in the middle of it, but, you know, look, privatization, deregulation, and the anti-government poison that they've been spewing for 40-plus years, all of this stuff is now coming to a head in this situation, and this is just one of what potentially could be multiple situations like this going down the road, and my hope is that we take this moment and go, we kind of do need a government that's functional. We kind of need people who believe that government can do things and make sure that it does do things, you know, like letting people know there's a big storm coming.
Yeah. And it's, for me at this point, I know that the storm forecasting has obviously passed us by. And at this point, we're really in the response and recovery piece of it. And just the gutting of FEMA and how many hurdles have been put in their way in order for them to actually do their jobs in a timely manner and to the best of their ability. It's been really hard. I'm actually, the start of my career, I was a municipal firefighter and first responder. And in times like this, when these emergency disasters happen, it really hits home for me that how important it is that first responders have everything that they need in order to help people out, and that they can hit the ground, and that the red tape isn't in their way. There's not bureaucracy getting in their way. There's been reports by the New York Times and CNN who've talked to FEMA staff, and they're like, we normally are on the ground within a couple hours. This time around, it was 72 hours, and there were so many different hurdles in their way. It's really hard to watch that, and it's really hard to know that these resources are still there. They haven't totally been cut yet, but they were not allowed access to actually do their job.
So why? I mean, look, you know, this is... Again, there's a lot of things I used to think that are nonpartisan, FEMA being one of them. When disaster happens, we all come together. We all, you know, help our neighbors. We all help our communities. At least that was my thought. And look, Texas, a very red place. I would have thought Trump would have had every resource available. Everybody, all hands on deck. 72 hours to get them there. That somebody should at least lose their job. And maybe a whole bunch of people in the decision-making process should be going by the wayside.
Well, Last week, Trump said that you had people there as fast as anybody's ever seen, is what he told DHS Secretary Noem. And I mean, in my opinion, it would seem to be prudent that the blame lie with the people who have been hindering the response and recovery effort, which is Trump and those in his administration. Like, putting the blame on the staff on the ground who are doing everything they can in their power, putting the blame on the staff who is like ready, boots on, want to get on the ground, and we're told that they have to wait until Secretary Noem gives her approval. That does not seem right to me.
Yeah. You know, I used to remember, and again, this is maybe I'm showing my age a little bit, but I used to remember when presidents believed the Truman quote of the buck stops here. I don't know how we've gone to, well, the buck, that guy down there, he did it. I don't know how we got there. I don't know how we got here.
I mean, honestly, I think what you have said on your show before about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, I don't think it's just Trump and his administration. What we saw in there was that they repealed all unobligated funds that the Biden administration had designated for improving research, forecasting, monitoring, public communication, everything we need during extreme weather disasters. It's a potential rollback of about $100 million that would have gone towards that. Problem is, we don't know the exact amount for sure until we get the CBO score, which Republicans didn't care to get prior to passing this bill. I have, you know, fun names for it that
Not FCC friendly. I got you, because I got it too. When it passed, I went through that rant myself. But it accomplished Republican goals: enrich the very wealthy while kicking the very poor. It's pretty simple in my view. They got what they wanted.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this: as a first responder, because you know, we have not in this country, I think, done a sufficient job in ensuring that we're ready for disaster. I thought we should have been funding FEMA at a much higher level. But I have people who are saying, you know what? It's clear government can't do this. You know where I'm going. We should privatize FEMA. As somebody who's been on the ground when FEMA shows up, because I haven't, do you support privatizing?
I think one of the worst things you can do with social services or support services, things designed to help all of us, is privatize them. The last thing that you want to tell someone that they need to do in an emergency or in a recovery or a rebuild is that they have to pay a little extra for it. Just the inequities that you see happen when things get privatized. I mean, do you really want to have to pay to have a more accurate weather forecast? Do you even want to have to think about that while you're seeing floodwaters rise? Do you want to have to think about, do I have the extra money as I just lost my entire house to then pay for someone to come and help me figure out what I need to do to rebuild, what grants I need to apply for, what special assistance I need? Like, there are certain things that just should not be privatized. Also, forecasting, who is going to pay for the weather satellites? Who's going to pay for the scientists and the forecasters? What private company has that kind of resources and money to do everything that, say, the National Weather Service and NOAA and NASA do to bring us our forecasts and allow us to hopefully have enough notice that we can evacuate if needed or just shore up our defenses locally?
The billionaire's republic of Elon, of course, because I guess he just got another big contract. Starlink is already there. We could just give it to Elon. Elon could do it.
And how much would Elon charge each of us when we're in our most desperate hour? It's just the last thing I personally would want is for any of these resources to be privatized. I don't think that privatization is going to give me more trust in the organization, probably less, because I know that the business is going to be out for its bottom dollar and not whether or not myself, my family, my community is really taken care of.
But there are certain
things that just should never be privatized.
100% with you on this. But, you know, I've had a lot of people say, you know, they couldn't do any worse. Yeah, they could. There are places across this country that have privatized fire departments. To where if you're not a subscriber, they're going to come and water down the houses next to you while yours burns to the ground. Is that the environment we want to live in? Is that the kind of country we want to live in? I don't either.
And recent polling has shown that I believe it's 74% of, or no, I think it's even more. I think it's 8 in 10 Americans believe that federal government should have a major role in providing aid to communities in the aftermath of these extreme weather disasters. I mean, and this is bipartisan support. People know that in instances like this, it's bigger than all of us. Natural disasters, extreme weather disasters, do not respect state boundaries. They do not respect political affiliation. Climate change, which is driving all of this, it's making these disasters more intense, more frequent, way more catastrophic. And that is not political.
I'm not a climatologist and I don't pretend to be. I don't have all the answers, but I'm kind of looking around going, 26 foot rise in the Guadalupe River in 45 minutes. Not even Noah could have gotten out of that.
No. Yeah. And what do you do at that point? We're doing the best we can with the response and in the moment, but afterwards, like, our communities need all the support all of us can give each other in order to recover and rebuild. And when in the rebuilding, also become more resilient to the next extreme weather disaster on the horizon. Because as we're seeing, they're just coming at us one after the other. There were 27 extreme weather disasters last year that had an economic cost, not just loss of life, but an economic cost of over $1 billion each. I think in total, it was like $183 billion is what we were looking at for climate disasters last year. That's incredible.
That is incredible. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, look, I don't want this to be it's all Trump's fault. Kind of is. It's Republicans' fault for being ill-prepared and abusing government the way they have. But what lessons are we to learn from this? Going forward, I want to make sure this never happens again. I want to make sure that kids going to a summer camp aren't washed away. I want to make sure that people don't wake up in the middle of the night and go, oh, crap, 26 feet of water is just taking my home away. What do we learn from this? What should we be pursuing? And are there policies that you see that could help?
I mean, honestly, we have to fully fund NOAA and National Weather Service, FEMA. That is the most straightforward answer I can give you. I'm a mom of three. I cannot even comprehend what the families are going through right now on the ground. My heart goes out to them. I think that I don't want any other family to ever be in this position again. And one of the things, or the main thing that I think we can do to make a difference is fully fund and support these agencies to do their job and provide the employees of these agencies, federal workers who are there because they believe in helping their fellow Americans, give them what they need to help all of us.
Yeah, I have very little faith that this administration will heed the warning and undo the damage they've done. This is why elections, in my view, have consequences and something maybe people should remember in a bit of time. But Margaret, I appreciate you taking time, sharing your expertise. I hope you'll come back and talk to us on something a little bit, you know, better, a little bit more positive, more hopeful down the road.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thank you for having me on.
Appreciate the time. Margaret Cooney, Senior Campaign Manager for Energy and Environmental Policy there at the Center for American Progress. Want to hear your thoughts. What's the lesson that you're getting from this? Are you seeing that, you know, elections have consequences? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that Ralph Gray was attacked for trying to organize black farmers. Gray was born to a large African-American family in Alabama. Living in the Jim Crow South, he became a tenant farmer. He joined the Communist Party. At the time, communist labor organizers were often more open to black membership and leadership than were other white-dominated labor organizations. Along with his brother Tommy, Ralph helped to found the Croppers and Farm Workers Union in Tallapoosa County, Alabama. They set to work organizing black sharecroppers. Then, several of the local landlords stopped providing food and money to their workers. They did this in an effort to force the black workers to labor on building a new sawmill. Angry sharecroppers joined the new union in protest. The union demanded more autonomy for the tenant farmers. They also demanded a longer school day and a public school bus for their children. Alarmed by this organizing, the sheriff, Kyle Young, led a posse to break up a union meeting. They beat and terrorized the union members. The vigilantes then went to Tommy Gray's house, where they fractured his wife's skull. Ralph Gray chased them off with a shotgun. But the next night, on July 16th, the union met again. Gray and others armed themselves to protect the meeting. Gunfire was exchanged. The sheriff shot Ralph Gray while he lay on the ground, already wounded. The mob of vigilantes then burned Gray's house to the ground. They placed Gray's mutilated corpse on the courthouse steps as a warning to any others who dare to stand up for the rights of black workers. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So yesterday I wanted to get to a couple more emails that I didn't get to because I've gotten a lot. You bash the Republicans, but the Democrats are bad. And look, I'm the first one to tell you, Democrats have not been the great savior that I want them to be and that we need them to be. But understand, I come from the position of Republicans. They're terrible. Their policies are horrible for working people. I still have some hope that Democrats will find their soul and maybe pursue the policies that they talk about, but maybe run on those. And then maybe we, the voting people, will go, yeah, we want those policies. The sad reality, and this has been, this has been 40 years in the making, where a lot of times it's cult of personality. It's what we see on TV. It's what's been presented to us. It's what we hear all the time. Look, everyone who said, Democrats suck. Yeah, they do in a lot of places. And a lot of everyone who says, it's getting harder. You're right. It's harder. The working and middle classes have been squeezed tighter than ever. And, both parties do share some of the blame. In the 1980s, a family could live on one income. It was possible. Before that, it was the norm. Today, it takes 2, 3, 4 incomes just to keep up. Housing costs have skyrocketed, gone through the roof. And you go back to, when I was growing up, houses were like two and a half times your yearly salary. Now, what's the last thing? Almost 10 times what the yearly salary is. And two things have gone on here. One, salaries haven't kept up. And two, Wall Street's found their way. They found their ability to buy up rental properties, and the cost of housing has just skyrocketed. So for me, yeah, there's a lot of problems here. And this is where Democrats have some room. Because I feel the frustration that everyone says, establishment Democrats, they suck. Your anger's real. It's justified. I'm with you. And look, too many Democratic leaders have cozied up to big moneyed interest, Wall Street, private equity. Yeah, they've pushed policies that don't help you or me. I look at crypto. as being the next one. And we're being sold that crypto is the answer to our... No! But here's the thing. If the Democrats want to work, want to win back the party of the working class, they want to win back working class voters, there are some things that need to be done. You know, I had a conversation with a guy the other day, working class voter like me. Him, the only thing he was focused on was the transgender issue. And I think Democrats screwed that up horribly. This idea that we're going to force people to agree with pronouns and that stuff, ridiculous. It should have been framed as I framed it all along. I'm a firm believer in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Everyone has the right to pursue their freedom, their happiness, their best life. You don't have the right to force me to agree with you. You do what you want to do. And as long as your rights don't infringe on mine, we're good. But this idea that we're going to be forced to do anything in this country never works. So this guy, it was all about the transgender issue. And it's not, again, it's not that he hates transgender people. It's like, it's the hate of you're telling me what I have to believe. And from a party that, from a group that preaches tolerance to be incredibly intolerant, kind of what got Democrats into this position. Now, as I've said before, I will fight for people in that category. I think they have the right to do whatever it is that they want to do in their lives. Has nothing to do with me. As long as their rights don't infringe on mine, we're good. But Democrats had better figure out how they're going to go back to the basics. Take that position of, look, everyone's got the right to do what they want. What do you care what someone else does? What business is it of yours? What we should be talking about are voting rights. Democrats should be the party of everybody being able to vote. Protect voting rights, expand voting rights. That should be your wheelhouse. Economic interest should be their wheelhouse. Economic populism. Raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Protect union rights. Invest in good-paying jobs. Especially manufacturing and the next generation of jobs. Healthcare should be an absolute. If you get sick, you should never go broke. That's simple. And we should be pursuing a tax policy where the people with the biggest shoulders carry the most water. This tax bill that Trump just rammed through is all about enriching the people who have the biggest shoulders, lightening their load even more while burdening the folks who, well, are broke already. And we should be pushing for pro-family policies, guaranteed family leave, guaranteed paid medical leave for every working person, strengthen workplace safety rules, crack down on companies who exploit immigrants and low-wage workers. Be true to your working class roots. Understand, Democrats, you got to stop being viewed as the party of Wall Street and be the party of Main Street. And that comes with policy. And don't run away every time someone says, you know, increasing the minimum wage is socialism. Making sure that people have health care is socialism. Don't be afraid of that. Ensuring that seniors aren't in poverty because you're going to expand Social Security. Don't run away from it. You should have learned the lesson of the Affordable Care Act. Head into it. Go through it. Stand for what you believe and fight for it. Even if we lose, at least you are fighting the good fight, fighting the right fight. And then I wouldn't get a bunch of emails from people, well, Democrats suck, which completely lets the Republicans off the hook. Because most of the bad policies, most of the horrible stuff that's been going on came out of right-wing think tanks, came out of Republican study groups. So Democrats, heads up, you got a chance. Trump's handing you a golden opportunity to be that party of working people. Question is, are we going to take it? Want to hear your thoughts? Send me those angry emails. Love them. My red hat friends, keep telling me if you're still on Team Trump. I want to hear that too. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, or if you get your podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A wildfire has closed access to the Grand Canyon and destroyed dozens of buildings. ABC's Faith Abube is in Arizona.
This fire is still 0% contained. Some historic parts of the canyon, though, already destroyed, including the Grand Canyon Lodge.
In Los Angeles, a suspect in custody for the deaths of an American Idol music supervisor and her husband. Police say Robin Kay and Thomas DeLuca were found shot dead in their home when police were conducting a welfare check. The Pentagon confirming that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered that 2,000 California National Guardsmen be withdrawn from the security mission in Los Angeles. It's almost half the 4,700 Guardsmen and Marines that were sent to the city in early June to protect federal property and personnel following anti-ICE protests. President Trump saying he's made a deal with congressional Republicans who earlier today voted against advancing his priority crypto legislation, and that the holdouts are now on board. A new roll vote will happen tomorrow. This is ABC News.